Chapter 26. "Magnificent," said Pitt.
"Gorgeous, simply gorgeous," Lily murmured.
Giordino nodded in agreement. "A real winner." They were standing in an antique and classic automobile restoration shop, and their admiring stares were directed toward a 1930 L29 Cord Town car, a model with an open front for the chauffeur. The body was painted burgundy, while the fenders were a buff that was matched by the leather-covered roof over the passenger's compartment. Elegantly styled, long and graceful, the car had front-wheel drive that helped to give it a low silhouette. The original coachmaker had stretched the chassis until it measured nearly 5.5 meters from front-to-rear bumper. Almost half the length was hood, beginning with a race car-type grille and ending with a sharply raked windshield. It was big and sleek, a thing of beauty that belonged to an era fondly revered by older generations but unknown to those who followed. The man who had found Pitt's car stored in an old garage, hidden under 40 years of trash, and had restored it from a mangled hulk, was proud of his handiwork. Robert S. Benson, a tall man with a pixie face and limpid blue eyes, gave the hood a final loving wipe with a dust cloth and turned the car over to Pitt.
"I hate to see this one go."
"You've done a remarkable job," said Pitt.
"Are you going to ship it home?"
"Not just yet. I'd like to drive it for a few days." S. Benson nodded.
"Okay, let me adjust the carburetor and distributor for our mile-high altitude.
Then, when you return to the shop, I'll have it detailed and arrange for an auto transporter to ship it to Washington."
"Can I ride in it?" Lily asked anxiously.
"All the way to Breckenridge," Pitt replied. He turned to Giordino. "Coming with us, Al?"
"Why not? We can leave the rental car outside in the parking lot."
They switched the luggage, and 10 minutes later, Pitt turned the Cord onto Interstate 70 and aimed the long hood toward the foothills leading into the snow-peaked Rocky Mountains. Lily and Al sat warmly in the luxurious passenger compartment, separated from Pitt by the divider window. Pitt did not pull out the transformable top that protected the chauffeur's seat, but sat in the open, bundled up in a heavy sheepskin coat, savoring the cold air on his face. For the moment, his mind was on his driving, scanning the instruments to make sure the 60-year-old car was performing as it was designed to do. He held to the right lane, allowing most of the traffic to pass and gawk. Pitt felt exhilarated and content behind the wheel, listening to the smooth purr of the 8-cylinder engine and the mellow tone of the exhaust. It was as though he had control over a living thing. If he had had any inkling of the mess he was driving into, he would have turned around and headed straight back to Denver. Darkness had fallen over the Continental Divide when the Cord rolled into the legendary Colorado mining town-turned-ski resort. Pitt drove up the main street, whose old buildings retained their historic western flavor. The sidewalks were crowded with people coming from the slopes, carrying their skis and poles over one shoulder. Pitt parked near the entrance of the Hotel Breckenridge. He signed the register and took 2 phone messages from the desk clerk. He read both slips of paper and slipped them into a pocket.
"From Dr. Rothberg?" asked Lily.
"Yes, he's invited us for dinner at his condo. It's just across the street from the hotel."
"What time?" Giordino queried.
7:30. Lily glanced at her watch.
"Only 40 minutes to shower and do my hair. I'd better get with it."
Pitt gave her the room key. "You're in 221. Al and I have rooms adjoining yours on each side." As soon as Lily disappeared with the porter into an elevator, Pitt motioned Giordino into the cocktail lounge. He waited until the barmaid took their drink order before passing the 2nd message across the table. Giordino read it aloud softly. "Your library project takes top priority. Most urgent you find a permanent address for Alex in the next 4 days. Luck, Dad." He looked up, utterly confused.
"Do I read this right? We have only 4 days to identify the location?"
Pitt nodded positively. "I read panic between the lines and smell something rumbling in Washington power circles."
"They might as well ask us to invent a common cure for herpes, AIDS, and acne," Giordino grumbled. "We can kiss off our skiing trip."
"We'll stay," said Pitt resolutely. "Nothing we can do until Jaeger gets lucky." Pitt rose from his chair. "And speaking of Jaeger, I'd better give him a call." He found a public telephone in the hotel lobby and made a call on his credit card.
After four rings, a voice answered in what sounded like the middle of a yawn.
Jaeger here.
Hiram, this is Dirk. How's your search going?
It's going.
Run onto anything?
My babies sifted through every piece of geological data in their little banks from Casablanca around the Horn to Zanzibar. They failed to find a hot spot along the coast of Africa that matched your drawing. There were three vague possibilities, but when I programmed profiles on landmass transformations that might have occurred over the past 1,600 years, none proved encouraging. Sorry.
What's your next step?
I'm already in the process of heading north. This will take more time because of the extensive shoreline encompassing the British Isles, the Baltic Sea, and the Scandinavian countries as far as Siberia.
Can you cover it in 4 days?
Only if you insist I put the hired help on a 24-hour schedule.
I insist, said Pitt sternly. Word has just come down that the project has become an urgent priority.
We'll hit it hard, Jaeger said, his voice more jovial than serious.
I'm in Breckenridge, Colorado. If you strike on something, call me at the Breckenridge Hotel. Pitt gave Jaeger the hotel phone and his room number. Jaeger dutifully repeated the digits.
Okay, got it.
You sound like you're in a good mood, said Pitt.
Why not? We accomplished quite a lot.
Like what? You still don't know where our river lies.
True, replied Jaeger cheerfully, but we sure as hell know where it ain't.
Snowflakes the size of cornflakes were falling as the three trudged across the street from the hotel to a two-story cedar-sided condominium. A flood-lighted sign read, Ski Queen. They climbed a stairway and knocked on the door to Unit 22B. Bertram Rothberg greeted them with a jolly smile beneath a splendid gray beard and sparkling blue eyes. His ears rose in full sail through a swirling sea of gray hair. A red plaid shirt and corduroy trousers clad his beefy body. Put an axe in one hand and a crosscut saw in the other, and he could have reported for duty as a lumberjack. He shook hands warmly and without introductions, as if he'd known everyone for years. He led them up a narrow stairwell to a combination living dining room beneath a high-peaked ceiling with skylights. "How does a gallon bottle of cheap burgundy sound before dinner?" he asked with a sly grin. Lily laughed.
"I'm game."
Giordino shrugged. "Makes no difference as long as it's wet." "And you, Dirk?"
"Sounds good."
Pitt didn't bother asking Rothberg how he recognized each of them. His father would have provided descriptions. The performance was nearly flawless. Pitt suspected the historian had worked for one of the government's many intelligence agencies at some time in the past. Rothberg retired to the kitchen to pour the wine. Lily followed.
"Can I help you with anything?"
She suddenly stopped and peered at the empty counters and the cold stove. Rothberg caught her curious look. "I'm a lousy cook, so our dinner will be catered. It should show up around 8. He pointed at the sectional couch in the living room. "Please get comfortable around the fire." He passed the glasses and then lowered his rotund figure into a leather easy chair. He raised his glass. "Here's to a successful search."
"Hear, hear," said Lily.
Pitt got off the mark. "Dad tells me you've made the Alexandria Library a life study."
32 years.
"Probably been better off to have taken a wife all that time instead of rummaging around dusty bookshelves and straining my eyes over old manuscripts. The subject has been like a mistress to me. Never asking, only giving. I've never fallen out of love with her."
Lily said, "I can understand your attraction."
Rothberg smiled at her.
"As an archaeologist, you would."
He rose and jabbed in the fireplace with a poker. Satisfied that the logs were burning evenly, he sat down again and continued.
"Yes, the library was not only a glorious edifice of learning, but it was the chief wonder of the ancient world, containing vast accumulations of entire civilizations."
Rothberg spoke almost as if he was in a trance, his mind seeing shadows from the past. "The great art and literature of the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Romans, the sacred writings of the Jews, the wisdom and knowledge of the most gifted men the world has ever known, the divine works of philosophy, music of incredible beauty, the ancient bestsellers, the masterworks of medicine and science. It was the finest storehouse of materials and knowledge ever assembled in antiquity."
"Was it open to the public?" asked Giordino.
"Certainly not to every beggar off the street," answered Rothberg. "But researchers and scholars pretty much had the run of the place to examine, catalog, translate, and edit, and to publish their findings." You see, the library and its adjoining museum went far beyond being mere depositories. Their halls launched the true science of creative scholarship. The library became the first true reference library, as we think of today, where books were systematized and catalogued. In fact, the complex was known as the Place of the Muses. Rothberg paused and checked his guest's glasses. "You look like you can use another shot of wine, Al."
Giordino smiled. "I never turn down a free drink."
"Lily? Dirk?"
"I've hardly touched mine," said Lily.
Pitt shook his head. "I'm fine."
Rothberg refilled Giordino's glass and poured his own before continuing. "Later empires and nations owe a staggering debt to the Alexandria Library. Few institutions of knowledge have produced so much. Pliny, a celebrated Roman of the 1st century A.D., invented and wrote the world's first encyclopedia. Aristophanes, head of the library 200 years before Christ, was the father of the dictionary. Callimachus, a famous writer and authority on Greek tragedy, compiled the earliest Who's Who. The great mathematician Euclid devised the first known textbook on geometry. Dionysius organized grammar into a coherent system and published his Art of Grammar, which became the model text for all languages written and spoken. These men and thousands of others labored and produced their epic achievements while working at the library.
"You're describing a university," said Pitt.
"Quite right. Together, the library and museum were considered the university of the Hellenistic world. The immense structures of white marble contained picture galleries, statuary halls, theaters for poetry reading, and lectures on everything from astronomy to geology. There were also dormitories, a dining hall, cloisters along colonnades for contemplation, and an animal park and botanical garden. 10 great halls housed different categories of manuscripts and books. Hundreds of thousands of them were handwritten on either papyrus or parchment, and then rolled into scrolls and stored in bronze tubes."
"What's the difference between the two?" asked Giordino.
"Papyrus is a tropical plant. The Egyptians made a paper-like writing material out of its stems. Parchment, also called vellum, was produced from the skins of animals, especially young calves, kids, or lambs."
"Is it possible they could have survived the centuries?" Pitt asked.
"Parchment should last longer than papyrus," answered Rothberg. Then he looked at Pitt. "Their condition after 1600 years would depend on where they've been stored. Papyrus scrolls from Egyptian tombs are still readable after 3,000 years.
A hot and dry atmosphere."
"Yes.
Suppose the scrolls were buried somewhere along the northern coast of Sweden or Russia."
Rothberg bent his head thoughtfully. "I suppose the winter freeze would preserve them, but during the summer thaw they would rot from the dampness."
Pitt could smell defeat looming down the road. This was one more nail in the coffin. Hope of finding the library manuscripts intact seemed dimmer than ever.
Lily did not share Pitt's pessimism. She had the glow of excitement on her face. "If you had been Junius Venator, Dr. Rothberg, what books would you have saved?"
"Hard question," Rothberg said, winking at her.
"I can only guess he might have attempted to save the complete works of Sophocles, Euripides, Aristotle, and Plato for a start. And, of course, Homer. He wrote 24 books, but only a very few have come down to us. I think Venator would have saved as many of the 50,000 volumes on Greek, Etruscan, Roman, and Egyptian history as his fleet of ships could carry. The latter would be extremely interesting, since the library's monumental store of Egyptian literature and religious and scientific material has all been lost. We know practically nothing about the Etruscans, yet Claudius wrote an extensive history on them that must have sat on the library shelves. I'd certainly have taken religious works on Hebrew and Christian laws and traditions. The revelations of these scrolls would probably knock the socks off modern biblical scholars."
"Books of the sciences," added Giordino.
"That goes without saying."
"Don't forget cookbooks," said Lily.
Rothberg laughed. "Venator was a shrewd operator. He'd have saved a general spread of knowledge and material, including books on cooking and household hints. Something for everyone, you might say."
"Especially the ancient geological data," said Pitt.
"Especially that," Rothberg agreed. "Has anything come down on what kind of a man he was?" inquired Lily.
"Venator?"
"Yes."
"He was the leading intellectual of his time.
A renowned scholar and teacher who was hired away from one of the great learning centers of Athens to become the last of the Alexandria Library's prominent curators. He was the great chronicler of his age. We know he wrote over 100 books of political and social commentary that covered the known world going back 4,000 years, none of which has survived."
Archaeological researchers would have a field day with data compiled by someone who was 2,000 years closer to our past, said Lily.
What else do we know about him? Pitt asked.
Not much. Venator attracted a large number of pupils who went on to become recognized men of letters and science. One student, Diocles of Antioch, mentioned him briefly in one of his essays. He described Venator as a daring innovator who struck out into areas other scholars feared to tread. Though a Christian, he saw religion more as a social science. This was the main cause behind the friction that existed between Venator and the Christian zealot Theophilus, Bishop of Alexandria. Theophilus went after Venator with a vengeance, claiming the museum and library were hotbeds of paganism. He finally persuaded the Emperor Theodosius, a devout Christian, to burn the place. In the uproar and riots that occurred between Christians and non-Christians during the destruction, it was supposed Junius Venator was murdered by fanatical followers of Theophilus.
But now we know he escaped with the pick of the collection, said Lily.
When Senator Pitt called with the news of your discovery in Greenland, said Rothberg, I felt as excited as a street sweeper who'd won a $1 million lottery.
Can you give us any thoughts on where you think Venator hid the artifacts? Asked Pitt.
Rothberg considered for a long moment. Finally, he said quietly, Junius Venator was not an ordinary man. He followed his own path. He had access to a mountain of knowledge. His route would have been scientifically planned. Only the unknowns were left to chance. He certainly did an efficient job when you consider the relics have remained hidden for 1,600 years.
Rothberg threw up his hands in defeat.
I can't offer a clue. Venator is too tough a customer to second guess.
You must have some idea, Pitt persisted.
Rothberg looked long and deeply into the flames wavering in the fireplace.
All I can say is, Venator's burial place must be where no man would think to look.